Hello, everyone, and welcome to Classic Gaming Today, where we take a look at the gaming experiences of the past through the eyes of the present. I am your host, Tony, and today we're going to look at Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge, a third-person point-and-click adventure title developed and published by LucasArts in 1991 for several different computer platforms, including MS-DOS, macOS, FM Towns, and Amiga. We're going to talk about that game in just a couple minutes, but first, as is usual, just a little bit of housekeeping up front. This is episode number 86, and it is another special episode because it is another Patreon-sponsored episode. This episode was sponsored by ISO, who has sent along this message for everybody to listen to and enjoy. So ISO, take it away!
Hi, my name is ISO. You may know me as the Annoying Challenge Fan from the CGT Discord. I'd like to dedicate this episode today to the Discord server. For anyone who hasn't joined, let me take this opportunity to convince you to sign up. This community is talked up every week by Tony, but I truly believe it's the best place for anyone looking for a heartfelt and meaningful discussion about all things gaming. We have gaming challenges, competitions, prizes, quizzes, and even a free community library. The effort and energy that Tony puts into this community is to be commended. He just goes above and beyond every week, coming up with new ideas and supporting the community. To all members, I'd like to personally thank you for all the fun and laughter we've had over the last, I believe it's a year now. It's helped me get through some tough days, and everybody on there has just been so great. Special shout outs to my bowling buddy Bookie Canoe, Rich Muscle Man Centerwall, Dave the Emulator Dizzle, Left Hand Guitarist Sam, Blue Fates, Sean, Steve, my brother Mercer, and well, practically everybody. There's too many to mention. Everybody that joins on has always got a positive attitude. And it's been so great to see this community build from the beginning, and I look forward to what the future holds. The episode I've picked today is Monkey Island 2. I loved this game as a kid, probably even more as an adult. Personally, I think the game is stunningly beautiful, witty, funny, and endlessly quotable. My fondest memory is being so scared at an unexpected surprise after solving a puzzle. It's about middle of the game. It involves a skeleton dance, no spoilers, but I'm sure you know the one I mean. It shook me, and even today, it hits pretty hard, even though I know it's coming. This is one of my faves, and despite what score Tony gives it today, I recommend everybody has a go. My brother is still trying to convince me to get a matching Guybrush tattoo, maybe one day. Thanks for listening to my ramblings, and we'll see you on Discord. Thank you.
Thank you, ISO, for your message, your sponsorship, and your support. And I 100% agree, this community around this podcast is absolutely awesome. If you want to sponsor a future episode or just talk about classic games, technology, or pretty much anything in general, there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT. I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com. And like ISO was talking about, we have our Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is pretty darn awesome. ISO said it better than I can, so I am just going to leave it at that. I highly encourage you all to check it out. I also highly encourage you to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a Patreon-exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, Patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday is where it's at. I'd also like to give a shout out to our Pantheon patrons. They are ISO, Rich Centerwall, David Morton, Sam Twardowski, Sean Marshall, Steve Novoselic, and Wendell Jr. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you all for supporting the show, whether you contribute monetarily or simply listen on a regular basis. I truly do appreciate all of the support. For anyone who may be new, welcome. I'd like to give a brief overview of the anatomy of an episode because, for the most part, all of our episodes follow a very similar format and structure. We will always start by talking about the history of the game in question, the historical context. How was the game made? Why was the game made? And then we move into a pseudo-review kind of section. And I say pseudo-review because it's not like we assign a numerical ranking or star counts or anything like that. But we do talk about every single game from several different perspectives. We take a look at the graphics. How does the game look? The sound and music. How does the game sound? The narrative and/or story. If the game has one, playability and controls, and overall feel. What does it feel like to play the game today versus when it was released 20, 30, maybe even 40 plus years ago? We do all of that to reach a verdict as far as how well the game holds up today. And to do that, we assign each game to one of several categories. At the very top of our list is the Pantheon of Classic Gaming. If a game reaches the Pantheon, you know it is that darn good. It is a certifiable classic. You should go out of your way to play those games today. Just beyond the Pantheon are our golden oldies. These are still really good games. I still highly encourage you to play them, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game exists. You should almost definitely have a good time. They're not quite Pantheon level, but they are still really worthwhile experiences, and I still highly encourage you all to play them today. Beyond the golden oldies, we reach our mediocre mentions. This is where we start getting into the realm of games that I cannot recommend to the broad population. They might have aged a little bit, might have had a couple of issues to begin with. You may still have a good time, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game lives. By all means, give it a go. But I cannot recommend these titles to the broad population. And then beyond the mediocre mentions, we reach the footnotes. These are the games that are best left in the annals of history. I have played them, so you don't have to. I cannot recommend anyone play these titles today. They have either aged incredibly poorly, or they may not have been all that great to begin with. With that out of the way, we're going to start talking about the game of the day. That is Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge. Monkey Island 2 LeChuck's Revenge is a third-person point-and-click adventure title developed and published by LucasArts in 1991 for several different computer platforms, including the MS-DOS, macOS, FM Towns, and Amiga platforms. Before we can talk about Monkey Island 2, we need to give a brief refresher of the events that led up to its original conceptualization, which means we need to discuss the evolution of several legendary adventure game designers: Ron Gilbert, Tim Schafer, and Dave Grossman. Considering the number of times we've discussed Lucasfilm and later LucasArts adventure titles, longtime listeners will likely recognize some of what we're about to discuss, but I do think it provides some important context for the creation of our game of the day, Monkey Island 2. Anyway, to start, let's talk about Ron Gilbert, who over the course of his career would become as influential in the adventure game industry as nearly anyone else in history. Gilbert's earliest, and perhaps most important, claim to fame occurred as he was working on his very first adventure game, Maniac Mansion, in 1987. Gilbert had been inspired by other adventure games of the time, most prominently Sierra Online titles like King's Quest, where graphical representations of characters and environments were married with traditional text parser inputs to enable players to interact with the game. Gilbert was impressed by the graphical elements of those titles, but he was less enthused with the use of a text parser for player input, primarily because most text parsers expected certain, very specific keywords in order for something to actually happen. As an example, if a player typed a simple command like turn on light switch, but the game was expecting a command like flip light switch, then nothing would actually happen, and the game would complain that it couldn't understand what action the player was attempting to perform. despite the fact that the two commands represented the same exact action. Games weren't always smart enough to equate multiple synonym-like words to each other, which would lead to frustrations for anyone unlucky enough to not guess what word or words the game's designers were expecting. Gilbert had a vision to change all of that via a mouse-driven interface where game commands could be constructed using a hard-coded and visible list of verbs, which, combined with an object or hotspot in the game world, would represent a potential action for the player to take. With the explicit definition of which commands were available to players, Gilbert reasoned that individuals playing the game would experience less frustration, which would hopefully improve engagement and fun. This general concept is what formed the foundation of the Scum engine, or script creation utility for Maniac Mansion, and that engine would form the foundation of nearly every single Lucasfilm and LucasArts adventure title that would follow for the next 10 years, and would further inspire other adventure game developers across the entire industry. While Scum was created for Maniac Mansion, it wouldn't take long before other adventure titles would take advantage of the engine. And owing to the fact that Scum was rapidly becoming pervasive across Lucasfilm games, the entire adventure game department would be restructured to focus entirely on the Scum engine for future game development. That led to the creation of Scum University, which was a training program for Lucas employees to become familiar with the engine, with newer employees being known as Scumlets, until they reached a level of proficiency where they understood how to use the engine to effectively work in a game. As Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the graphic adventure, was in the process of being developed, two new Scumlets would join the Lucas team, those being Dave Grossman and Tim Schafer. Grossman and Schafer were assigned to work on Ron Gilbert's team, and almost immediately, the trio struck up a mentor-mentee kind of relationship, with Gilbert taking Grossman and Schafer under his wing and helping the two young Scumlets to become more proficient in their use of the Scum engine, after they had both impressed during their first assignment, which was playtesting Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the action game. Their next assignment would represent their first exposure to the Scum engine, which was the implementation of the Nintendo Entertainment System version of Gilbert's adventure title, Maniac Mansion. After Maniac Mansion for the NES shipped, and following Gilbert's work on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, he began to think about what game he would focus on next, and here he would be inspired by an idea that he originally had back in 1988 while he was working on another Lucas adventure title, Zack McCracken and the Alien Mindbenders. While Gilbert was working on that title, he conceptualized a new comedic adventure focused on exploring a pirate-themed world, complete with sword fights, ghostly pirate crews, and a swashbuckling hero who would do everything he could to save the day, and hopefully get the girl in the process. Before Gilbert could actually start working on that title, though, there was an all-hands-on-deck kind of situation with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where pretty much everyone at Lucasfilm was tasked with bringing that title to life. After Last Crusade shipped, Gilbert had an opportunity to return to that original pirate idea, which is what would eventually lead to the creation of The Secret of Monkey Island. Gilbert's design ideas for Secret of Monkey Island were much too large for a single person to create, which is what led him to formally recruit Tim Schafer and Dave Grossman to the team. And with that trio in place, the game would be turned from concept into reality, eventually releasing to the delight of adventure gamers everywhere in late 1990. While we spoke at length about the development of The Secret of Monkey Island during our first Monkey Island podcast episode last year, something we didn't talk about were various concepts and design ideas that were not able to be included in that original title. And here, it's important to remember that for nearly every game ever created, the final product hardly ever implements every single feature or story beat that the game's designers intended. Many times, designs evolve over time, and certain sequences or segments that might seem like a good idea early in the development process might turn out to not fit all that well as development progresses. Or perhaps some design ideas are simply too big for a single game, or too complex to implement in time for a game's shipping date. In those cases, these ideas might end up on the cutting room floor, so to speak, potentially never living to see the light of day. The thing is, though, as Ron Gilbert and the team were creating The Secret of Monkey Island, Gilbert himself was conceptualizing what a potential sequel to the title would involve, and even before Monkey Island 1 was released, Gilbert had drafted out a rough outline of what a Monkey Island 2 would look like. This wasn't anything quote-unquote official yet, but Gilbert had a grand vision in mind, and was actually interested in creating a trilogy of Monkey Island titles. The Secret of Monkey Island was supposed to be the introduction into the game world, lore, and characters that make up the Monkey Island universe. Future titles, Gilbert thought, would be able to build upon that framework. So, when Gilbert and the team came across ideas, or puzzles, or even locations that for whatever reason wouldn't fit within the context of The Secret of Monkey Island, Gilbert ended up preserving those ideas in the hopes that he would eventually be able to use them in a hypothetical sequel. He didn't know if that sequel would end up happening, but he knew he wanted to be prepared in case he would be given the opportunity to continue developing Monkey Island games. For his part, Gilbert wanted to do everything in his power to make Monkey Island 2 a reality, even though Monkey Island 1 had yet to be released. And here, the general leadership culture of Lucasfilm Games ended up coming to his aid. We've talked briefly about this before, but Lucasfilm Games had a very loose leadership structure in the late 80s and early 90s, promoting an environment where creators would be given carte blanche to work on and create pretty much whatever they thought would make a good game. That's not to say that there wasn't any leadership oversight, but generally speaking, if a game designer came up with an idea they were passionate about, the Lucasfilm leadership team would support that designer. There was only one potential issue that could override even the greatest creative idea, and that would be the commercial viability of a title. Adventure games of the time, despite being a beloved genre that many gamers enjoyed, were not really big sellers in comparison to other video game properties. As an example, when we've talked about console games in prior episodes, it hasn't been uncommon for us to reference millions of copies sold, even for titles released in the 80s. By contrast, the most successful Lucas adventure games, despite their quality and popularity amongst the adventure game playing population, might, and I stress might, reach 100,000 sales over their lifetime, and that would be for a really successful adventure game. With the original Monkey Island not even having been released yet, Gilbert was concerned that his plans for a sequel might be derailed before they even had a chance to be pitched, and he had a real fear that if The Secret of Monkey Island wasn't a big success, that he'd be assigned to work on a game with a known brand or commodity, like Star Wars, or even perhaps a return to Indiana Jones, as opposed to continuing to be free to create his own unique adventures. So, Gilbert did what any enterprising individual in this situation would do. He began working on Monkey Island 2 by himself before any sort of official approval was granted. His thought was, if he could bring his pitch to Lucasfilm leadership and show them that it had gone beyond a simple concept and actually had some real work behind it, that he might be given approval to proceed with the title, despite the uncertain commercial viability of a new Monkey Island adventure game. In many companies, the response to that kind of unapproved work might have resulted in the loss of a job, but in Lucasfilm of the time, with a culture focused on giving creators the freedom to explore their own ideas, this kind of effort was viewed as having ambition and initiative, as opposed to demonstrating insubordination. After several persuasive discussions with leadership, Gilbert was given the approval to proceed with a sequel to The Secret of Monkey Island, and right after that game was released, work began, officially, on Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge. Because Gilbert had gotten the green light to develop a sequel before the first game had even shipped, he was able to keep the majority of his team intact, including the dynamic duo of Tim Schafer and Dave Grossman, who had both been tasked with creating various dialogue, game mechanics, and puzzles for the original Monkey Island, with different aspects of the game being divided up based on Schafer's and Grossman's unique humor and perspectives. For Monkey Island 2, that same kind of division of duties would remain in place, only this time, the game would be designed to include a much larger scope than any prior Lucasfilm adventure title made to date. Right around the time Monkey Island 2's development began, a couple of changes occurred that would end up altering the trajectory of Lucasfilm Games as a company. For one, the entirety of Lucasfilm and all of its subsidiaries went through a large-scale corporate reorganization, which is what resulted in the rebranding of Lucasfilm Games to LucasArts, with Monkey Island 2 being the first adventure game that would be released as a LucasArts title. The second change is one that would be driven primarily by Monkey Island 2's ambitious scope, and that was a shift to how LucasArts, as a company, would manage their projects moving forward. Throughout the 80s and into the very early 90s, the process of designing and developing games inside Lucasfilm Games could best be described as a very iterative, reactive kind of experience. Rather than having detailed design documents and defined milestone dates for various capabilities and features, teams would work using a more fluid kind of model, where new features would be added if something seemed cool, regardless of if it was planned for initially, and features that didn't work would simply be dropped from a title. If a title had additional scope added to it, that was totally fine, as long as projects remained on budget, and the new scope was being added in service of making a better game, which at the end of the day was the goal of every single employee at Lucasfilm Games. That process worked perfectly fine for smaller scale projects with fairly limited scope to begin with, but as team sizes began to increase, and game scope began to broaden, maintaining such a loose design and development process had the potential for introducing significant issues that could possibly result in over-budget projects with ever-increasing schedule delays. And Monkey Island 2, with its proposed multiple island structure and interlocking puzzles stretching over numerous locations, was certainly more complex than other Lucas Adventure titles to date. So, Gilbert and the team decided to implement a much more stringent, phase-based approach to creating the title, where during each phase, certain specific progress guidelines needed to be met before proceeding forward with the project. This meant that Monkey Island 2, for the first time in LucasArts, would be assigned a full team up front, rather than piecemeal recruiting as the project progressed, and would have a defined project plan and schedule that the team would be held accountable to meeting. The overall development of Monkey Island 2 would eventually pass through three distinct phases. Phase 1, as you might expect, was effectively a prototype kind of stage, where artists created rough pencil sketches of various scenes and characters in the game. Programmers would modify the Scum engine and any related subroutines to meet the needs of the game's design and puzzles, music would begin to be conceptualized, and puzzles would begin being tested for reasonableness. At the end of Phase 1, the Monkey Island 2 team would have a playable version of the title with monochrome graphics, placeholder art, and the rough outline of the entire game world and various interactions that players could take within that game world. Completion of Phase 1 was met with what LucasArts called a pizza orgy, which honestly sounds kind of amazing, during which time the entire company would be invited to playtest the current version of the game, provide feedback on what's working and what isn't, and presumably be fed as much pizza as their bodies could possibly endure. With feedback gathered, the team would then move on to Phase 2 of the project, which was effectively a period of time where programmers and artists would refine the work that they already completed as part of Phase 1. During this phase, art would be tweaked and colored using digital paint programs like Photoshop and Deluxe Paint, character and environment animations would be implemented, programming bug fixes and additional Scum engine modifications would be completed, musical themes would continue to be added and refined, and marketing materials would be finalized for the game's eventual release. And finally, Phase 3 would be reserved for putting the final coat of polish on the game, which, though it might not have been referred to as such back in the early 90s, represented a crunch mode kind of situation for all of the individuals working on the title, where they worked significant overtime hours in the evening and weekends in order to bring the game over the finish line. Interestingly, the majority of the team ended up not being too negatively impacted by the significant work-life balance issues that crunch time introduced, primarily because the majority of the staff simply likened the experience to their college years, where they'd often have to spend countless hours cramming for tests or completing research papers with little sleep and even less free time. I'm not sure if that's really an endorsement for the crunch mode style of project completion, but at least the majority of the team didn't feel undue strain as they worked to complete the title. With the high-level structure of how the project would progress defined, let's turn our attention to more specific aspects of the title, and we'll start by talking about what is arguably one of the most important features of any adventure game, that being the puzzle design. Like we mentioned earlier, Monkey Island 2 was conceptualized to be a dramatically larger scope than prior LucasArts adventure titles, with a series of interconnected puzzles that could potentially span multiple islands and require a series of precursor steps and puzzles that would ultimately lead to an overarching puzzle solution. This level of complexity was so vast that it led Gilbert to create massive flowcharts depicting the interconnected nature of each puzzle and how solutions would flow from one puzzle into inputs from another puzzle. These flowcharts, which Gilbert called puzzle dependency charts, would act as a roadmap for how each and every puzzle in the game was meant to connect to one another, and in the process, would define how the game's overall structure would eventually be implemented. the act of actually creating the puzzles in the game featured an interesting approach as well, and really serves to speak to how LucasArts' best and brightest adventure game designers approached puzzle design. Anyone who has played a LucasArts adventure likely realizes that most puzzles, while making sense within the context of each game's world, don't always follow the most logical sequence of events to arrive at a solution. And it turns out, this obfuscated game but not real world logic is entirely by design. When Gilbert and the team set out to create a puzzle, they would start by listing out all of the logical solutions that a player might typically think about when presented with a given situation. You know, the things you might do in real life if you were trying to solve the issue at hand. Well, they took all of those ideas and effectively threw them out. In other words, the most logical responses were automatically disqualified from being a potential solution in the game. The team would then begin to think about less logical solutions that would end up having the same end result, and over a period of time, they would continue to iterate on these ideas until they arrived at the puzzle design that would ultimately make its way into the final game. In a way, each puzzle solution does make logical sense. It's just a generally more convoluted path to get to the solution, which in turn drives game difficulty for avid adventure gamers. And speaking of difficulty, one of the overriding design goals for the game was to be as accessible as possible for a wide range of gamers, which is what led to the team including two difficulty modes in the game. One would be the full-fledged Monkey Island 2 experience, complete with devilishly complex puzzles designed to challenge even the most hardcore adventure gamers, while a second, less complex difficulty setting was designed to be a sort of Monkey Island-lite experience, where less experienced players could still have some fun with the title, while at the same time not having to figure out all of the different puzzle chains that made up the full experience. Speaking on how the team addressed the creation of two different sets of puzzles and experiences, Gilbert explained that the team actually started with the more complex puzzle definitions, and then looked at how different pieces of the interconnected puzzle chain could be removed in order to simplify the experience for the light version of the title, creating what the team considered pre-solved puzzles. There were still puzzles included with the light version of the experience, but just as a hypothetical example, a puzzle chain that might require 7 steps in the full experience might only require 2 in a light playthrough, with the 5 missing puzzle steps effectively being pre-solved so that players didn't need to figure out the intervening steps themselves. Surprisingly, creating puzzles in this reverse kind of fashion, rather than starting with a simple definition of puzzles in the games and then adding complexity, was much easier for the team to implement, and in turn preserved the overall playability of the title, regardless of which difficulty option was selected. Turning our attention to the game's graphics and art, Monkey Island 2 would usher in yet another new change to the traditional LucasArts production process, as the company realized that in order to compete with other industry heavyweights of the time, they would need to improve their own internal processes. LucasArts' chief competitor, Sierra Online, had invested heavily in the concept of digitizing backgrounds and actors to include in their titles, a technique that was considered revolutionary in the early 90s. And LucasArts would ultimately embrace similar technology, at least as far as digitizing artwork was concerned. Monkey Island 2 would see a larger art team beyond the group that worked on its predecessor, with different artists splitting duties between character art and animation, background and environmental drawings, and marketing material creation, with veteran artist Steve Purcell and new employee Peter Chan effectively splitting the role of lead artist, though both have historically been hesitant to claim that title for themselves, instead choosing to focus on the collaborative environment they both experienced while working on the game. And within that collaborative environment, there was some exciting new technology being introduced, as Monkey Island 2 would be designed to leverage VGA, or Video Graphics Array technology, which meant that artists now had access to 256 colors on screen at any point in time, a dramatic increase over EGA's 16-color limit. That increase in color depth, coupled with digitizing technology that allowed artists to create their work on paper before applying computer-driven limitations to the art, led to visuals that were, for LucasArts at the time, pretty much the most advanced-looking adventure title in their overall game catalog. Turning our attention to music, the game would be scored by veteran LucasArts composer Michael Land, along with 2 new hires into the company, Peter McConnell and Clint Bajakian, both of whom were friends of Land who he had known in college and high school respectively. With those 2 new hires in place, LucasArts would inadvertently create a musical trinity of creative geniuses who would go on to score nearly every other LucasArts game throughout the entirety of the 90s. Not only would this team be responsible for the most iconic music LucasArts would create, but Michael Land and Peter McConnell would end up co-designing a new piece of technology that would be introduced for the first time in Monkey Island 2. That technology was the Interactive Music Streaming Engine, or iMuse. We have spoken about iMuse before in various episodes of the podcast, but just to give some background, Michael Land was frustrated during the creation of The Secret of Monkey Island, as he felt that the game audio just wasn't able to deliver a truly cinematic, engaging experience. Sure, you could compose amazing soundtracks and themes, but game technology of the time treated those themes as simply tracks to play whenever a player took a certain action, as opposed to movies where soundtracks were composed and tailor-made to fit the action happening on the screen. As an example, in most games made around this time, musical themes would be specific to a given location you might be visiting, and would simply play on a loop as long as you remained in that location, regardless of what you might do in that scene. Upon leaving that scene, the game audio would typically fade out of the currently playing track and fade in on the new musical track that was assigned to accompany that new screen, in a process that wasn't exactly jarring, but also didn't really feel cinematic or smooth. Land realized there was an opportunity for improvement here, and he, along with Peter McConnell, sat down to create a technology that would allow LucasArts composers to create a dynamic game soundtrack where the music would constantly shift based on the scene on the screen and the actions the player would perform, without any appreciable break in the music. This technology was known as iMuse, and would form the foundation for nearly every LucasArts game created following its creation. Using iMuse, game soundtracks would mimic those found in film, with Ron Gilbert commenting that the soundtrack for Monkey Island 2 would, as a result, be one ever-evolving piece of music, rather than a series of discrete tracks that faded in and out of existence at various points throughout the game. With the game's art, music, puzzles, overall design, and Scum Engine refinements finally coming together, Monkey Island 2 LeChuck's Revenge would release to gamers around the world in December of 1991, with critics and gamers alike praising Monkey Island 2's story, puzzles, graphics, music, and pretty much everything else to do with the title. It would go on to become widely acclaimed as one of the best adventure games ever created, and would appear on numerous best games of all time lists, a spot where it continues to reside for countless gamers around the world. Commercial performance, however, was less than stellar, with only 25,000 copies sold, which within LucasArts was considered a pretty big failure, as most quote-unquote popular adventure games for the company were expected to sell at least 100,000 copies. As we've seen in the past, adventure games, while popular, never really sold quite as well as other genres' best offerings, though there were certainly exceptions. Interestingly, LucasArts was so disappointed with the sales for the game that they went to the team of Gilbert, Schaefer, and Grossman and told them that they shouldn't work on Monkey Island games anymore. Instead, they wanted them to focus on something that would be more viable from a commercial perspective. According to Schaefer, those comments from LucasArts leadership would eventually lead him to develop the concept behind Full Throttle, a decidedly more successful and mainstream adventure title. And if anyone wants to know more about that one, you can check out our episode from several months ago. Beyond the critical acclaim and the commercial disappointment, Monkey Island 2 would also not be without some controversy. For one, there was one puzzle included in the game, what I'll simply call the Monkey Wrench puzzle, that was based on an English language common phrase that didn't really translate all that well into the international market, creating a situation where a number of gamers didn't know what the heck the logic was behind that particular puzzle. In retrospect, Gilbert recognized this was an issue, and he and the rest of LucasArts took efforts in future titles to avoid situations where certain puzzles or game sequences might fall flat with certain portions of gamers. The second, perhaps bigger controversy, has to do with the game's ending, which Gilbert designed using a plot device that I will absolutely not spoil here, but is absolutely something that was divisive within the adventure game community upon its release, and remains a bit of a what-the-heck-just-happened kind of moment even over 30 years later. For his part, Gilbert had always envisioned Monkey Island as a trilogy of games, and he did in fact have an idea for how to address this plot device, if he were given the chance to create a third entry in the series. As we'll soon find out, that didn't happen, at least back in the 90s, though he did eventually provide his direct follow-up to Monkey Island 2's cliffhanger ending with the release of Return to Monkey Island in 2022. I haven't yet played that one, but I am definitely looking forward to it. With the release of Monkey Island 2, big changes would start happening within the adventure game division of LucasArts. Tim Schafer and Dave Grossman, having proven their adventure game expertise, would be given an opportunity to co-lead their first game, which would eventually result in the Maniac Mansion sequel, Day of the Tentacle. Ron Gilbert, meanwhile, would end up leaving LucasArts early on during the creation of Day of the Tentacle to form a new company, Humongous Entertainment, a company that would be focused on creating a series of what they called junior adventure titles aimed at children as opposed to the battle-hardened veteran adventure game aficionados that LucasArts was continuing to cater to. The story behind the creation of Humongous Entertainment and their evolution as a company under Ron Gilbert's leadership is interesting in its own right. But that particular discussion is a story for another day. Monkey Island 2 over the years would continue to be well regarded, so much so that in 2010 it would receive the special edition treatment, much the same as its predecessor, and similar to the way many of LucasArts' classic adventure titles would be remastered over time. Like the special edition for The Secret of Monkey Island, Monkey Island 2's special edition would feature brand new, high-quality artwork and graphics, improved audio quality, the ability to mix and match old and new elements of the design as you play the game, and a fully voiced experience with cast members from future Monkey Island titles reprising their roles for the special edition. I didn't mention it before, but Monkey Island 2 completely eschewed the CD-ROM talkie release kind of thing that many game development studios were embracing at the time, instead choosing to focus on delivering a quality text-based story and dialogue system. With the special edition remake, Monkey Island 2 would receive voiceover dialogue for the first time, and unlike The Secret of Monkey Island special edition, which I thought had some inconsistent performances, especially for Guybrush Threepwood, Monkey Island 2's special edition would be delightful to listen to. I don't know what changed between the two special edition releases, but from my perspective, Monkey Island 2's was dramatically improved over its predecessor. Regardless of whether you played the original game or its special edition remake, Monkey Island 2 has remained, for many, a standout entry in the adventure game genre. Through a unique combination of talent, skill, and determination, the adventure game team at LucasArts created a title that would end up transcending time, becoming a beloved game that sits near the pinnacle of adventure game design. While I'll share my own opinions of the game in just a little bit, suffice it to say that Monkey Island 2, as a prime example of the classic LucasArts adventure formula, will undoubtedly remain a game that is remembered fondly by countless gamers forever. We are now going to shift to start talking about what it feels like to play Monkey Island 2 LeChuck's Revenge today versus when it was released over 30 years ago. So LeChuck's Revenge is, as with most of the LucasArts adventure game catalog, a scum engine title, which itself connotes a very specific kind of gameplay experience. In games based on the scum engine, you utilize a mouse-based interface to interact with the game world, its inhabitants, and any objects, inventory items, or hotspots through the use of constructed verb and object command sentences. LeChuck's Revenge belongs to the earlier slate of scum-based games, which means that you have a series of verbs displayed on the screen as text, with your inventory items included to the right of those commands. Playing the game involves combining the displayed verb commands with various objects and items in the world, forming short sentences that depict the action you want to take within that game world. As an example, let's say you have a wallet in your inventory. If you wanted to access the contents of that wallet, you might select Open from the verb command list, and then click the wallet in your inventory, forming the simple executable sentence, Open Wallet. Assuming you've constructed a sentence that the game believes is valid given the context of the game world, something will happen. If not, or if you put in a series of words that make little sense, like open monkey, then the game will effectively tell you that you can't execute that command, albeit in a much nicer way than simply saying, stop being stupid, you can't open a monkey. Anyway, the structure for LeChuck's Revenge is an evolved form of the structure from the very first Secret of Monkey Island game, and represents a significant expansion in terms of scope, complexity, and interactivity. In The Secret of Monkey Island, you traversed several different locations, each of which had their own overworld maps, creating an interconnected world that felt fairly large, while at the same time still feeling relatively compact, as at any point in time, you only ever had to worry about a single map's worth of locations and content. LeChuck's Revenge takes that concept and expands it dramatically. What starts out as a romp around a single island eventually becomes an island-hopping affair that requires considerable back-and-forth progress across multiple discrete maps and locations, with interconnected puzzles that span the entire game world. I cannot stress enough how much more complex this design is in comparison to its predecessor. This was not a tiny step forward beyond Secret of Monkey Island. This was a number of gargantuan leaps into the future, and I was pleasantly surprised by the complexity at play here. In fact, the general design structure reminded me of another classic LucasArts title, albeit one that came out later, Day of the Tentacle. In Day of the Tentacle, you effectively explore three different lands concurrently, albeit in that game, the lands, so to speak, are actually alternate time frames representing the past, present, and future. In LeChuck's Revenge, the different lands you puzzle your way through are Scab Island, Fat Island, and Booty Island, and conceptually, the design is almost identical to Day of the Tentacle's time-traveling shenanigans. This surprised me more than I expected it to. For those who are unaware, I had never played LeChuck's Revenge before this recent playthrough, though I did understand the general structure of the game. Experiencing it firsthand, though, and seeing how closely Day of the Tentacle inherited from its design, left me feeling even more impressed than I thought it would. I've always held Day of the Tentacle in high regard, as I felt like the three distinct timeframes with interconnected puzzles created an adventuring experience that is pretty tough to beat, but seeing a similar kind of structure implemented here, in an arguably more complex series of interconnected puzzle and item combinations, made me take pause. I had assumed Day of the Tentacle broke the mold when it did what it did. In reality, it seems like it took the mold created by LeChuck's Revenge and tweaked it a bit before baking it to a golden brown, delicious confection. And speaking of delicious confections, LeChuck's Revenge provides a lot to sink your teeth into, as the game is filled with the kind of logic-bending, pun-filled puzzles that most adventure gamers, myself included, find absolutely delightful. Figuring out how to progress in the game is an achievement in and of itself, and it's not hyperbole to say that some of the puzzles in LeChuck's Revenge are deviously difficult. Ultimately, every single puzzle has a logical solution, at least within the context of the slightly illogical construct of the game's world, but I would be lying if I said I was able to figure out every single puzzle without a bit of assistance. At the end of the day, there were two puzzles that I had extra difficulty with, and we're going to talk about each of them at length a little bit later on. I'm going to avoid spoilers, as I usually do, but hopefully for those who have played the game, I'll be able to drop just enough hints for everyone to know exactly what I'm talking about. And by the way, for those who might be wondering, the monkey wrench puzzle was not one of the puzzles that I got stuck on, though I think the only reason I was able to solve that easily is because I had heard about it before, and given the way the inventory item looked when I examined it, I had a pretty strong feeling I knew how it was going to be used. Even knowing what a monkey wrench is, this probably would have given me pause, and likely would have been another puzzle I'd have some difficulty on. It's definitely logical only within the confines of this game world, and would not make sense in reality, so I can understand why some people have issues with that one. For the most part, though, all of the puzzles in the game are amazingly designed, and I loved how many puzzle solutions ended up being inputs to other puzzle solutions. I can only imagine what the puzzle flowchart looked like for this game. It had to have been pretty darn complex. Despite that complexity, though, and owing to LucasArts' desire to make all of their adventure games actually be user-friendly, or at least as user-friendly as adventure games can be, there are no dead-end states or game-ending deaths, at least as far as I could tell throughout my playthrough. There was one section of the game where I suppose I technically died, though the game was gracious enough to explain that away using a clever, though cliched, story device that allowed me to retry the situation, which I was then able to complete successfully. Aside from the puzzles, I have a lot to say about the game's dialogue, story, and ending, which, oh my god, I did not expect. But I'm going to save those discussions for when we begin talking about the more specific aspects of the game. Before we get to that, though, I should mention that my playthrough was based on playing the original version of LeChuck's Revenge, using the hard mode for all puzzle content. Unlike many adventure games, LeChuck's Revenge gives you an option when you start the game, where you can select to get the quote-unquote full experience, or you can instead opt for the light experience for the game. This difficulty selection represents the challenge level, and the number of puzzles that you experience throughout the game. Being an avid adventure game player, of course I was going to select the full experience, which based on my research is truly the way to play the game. From what I understand, the light version eliminates some puzzle chains entirely, making the game an almost too simple kind of experience. I suppose it's a valid option for individuals who don't enjoy traditional adventure game puzzles, but from my perspective, you're definitely robbing yourself of the experience of playing the game if you go that route. That said, the game itself has a ton to like beyond its puzzles, as its story, characters, dialogue, and environments are all top-notch. But if you're playing an adventure game, from my perspective, you need to get the full experience, even if that means needing to consult a guide every now and then. I should also mention that while I played the original version of the game, I did dabble a bit with the Special Edition remake as well, just to get a sense for how that version compared with the Secret of Monkey Island remake that we looked at previously. And I've got to say, nearly every complaint I had with the Secret of Monkey Island remake was addressed here, so much so that it felt like a dramatically better product than its predecessor. Every aspect of the remake was designed and completed lovingly, with perhaps the biggest improvement being the voice acting. If you listened to our Secret of Monkey Island episode, you may recall that I had some pretty harsh words for the voice acting included in the remake, and specifically the voice work of Dominic Armato, who provides the voice of main character Guybrush Threepwood. In the remake for the Secret of Monkey Island, I thought the voice work was decidedly lackluster, with a performance that I felt didn't really fit in with the character at all. So it was with low expectations that I fired up the LeChuck's Revenge remake, and let me tell you, holy cow, what a difference! I absolutely loved Armato's work here, and I felt like his performance lended an entirely different feel to the overall experience of playing the game. I cannot impress upon you how much better this performance was in comparison to the first game's remake. It felt as though the voice work was designed as a feature from the beginning rather than tacked on, and it made a world of difference. I don't know if this is because the writing in LeChuck's Revenge was more conversational to begin with, or if the acting direction was better, or if Armato simply did a better job here, but whatever it was a noticeable improvement, and I loved it. I'd love to talk more about Monkey Island 2 and the more specific aspects of the game as well, but first, as we always do, we need to take a look at the back of the box, because, as you all know, I love looking at the back of the box for these titles. I love learning how different companies marketed their games, especially because around this time, we didn't have YouTube to look up gameplay videos. We didn't have endless information about any game ever released. A lot of times, we may have had some magazine articles and reviews, but most of the time, when we were making a buying decision, we made that buying decision in the store looking at the box. Did the front of the box look cool? If so, we flip it over. Does the back of the box make it sound like something you'd enjoy? If so, you bought it. If not, it went back on the shelf. So, for Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge, the back of the box says, "He's big. He's bad. He's back. I thought I'd killed the ghost pirate LeChuck for good. Wrong. How many times can that bloated old fool die? Other pirates tell me there's no escape. When LeChuck wants you dead, they say. Legend has it that the treasure of Big Whoop holds the key to great power. I must find it before LeChuck finds me." Excerpted from the memoirs of Guybrush Threepwood, the Monkey Island Ears. 256 color scanned art, over 6.4 million pixels. Yeah, interactive reggae music, man. And yes, that's what the bullet says. Sorry. Laugh so hard, milk will come out your nose. Optional easy mode for beginners and magazine reviewers. Oh, that is a sick burn. And void where prohibited. Which, okay. And then there are some screenshots on the back of the box that show different scenes from the game. There are also some captions to some of those, which are pretty darn funny if you know what's happening inside the game. And I got to say, the back of the box here totally sold me on the game. It's just humorous. It feels funny. It feels interesting. I loved the bullet points that talk about the features. I especially loved the bullet that says optional easy mode for beginners and magazine reviewers, which, oh, that's really, that really is a got to call the burn unit on that one. But honestly, I love the back of the box on this one. This absolutely would have sold me had I purchased it back when it was originally released. I think I've told this story before, but I was primarily a Sierra kid back then, so I didn't do a whole ton of LucasArts adventure gaming. So I did not own this back when it was originally released in the early 90s. But looking at the box now, absolutely, I want this box on my shelf. Let's start looking at the more specific aspects of the game now. We're going to start by talking about the graphics. LeChuck's Revenge represents the state-of-the-art in LucasArts graphics for the time it was released, and let me tell you, the game looks great. I would wager that you're not going to find better pixel art in anything but the highest quality games, and the complexity of the environmental designs are to be commended. There is so much going on each screen, yet even with that complexity, the game never feels like a pixel hunt, as each usable item and hotspot, for the most part, is well telegraphed. Now, I say most, because there were a couple of screens in the game that did feel a bit too busy for its own good, primarily the antique store and the first room of the Voodoo Cabin. Both of those scenes contain a ridiculous number of items to examine, some of which are actually usable, while others are simply flavor text. At first glance, there is nothing to distinguish the important items from the unimportant items, and I felt like that was a bit of a design flaw in comparison to what it could have been. To be clear, I loved the number of interactive hotspots in those areas, and every single description was amusing and added to my overall enjoyment of the game. But from a purely graphical design perspective, the busier the scene, the more difficult it is for you to figure out what hotspots are important to your journey, versus just flavor or lore background kinds of things, and these two screens felt like they went a bit too far in the clickable sections department, especially because a number of the unimportant items kind of sounded like they should have been important given some of the puzzles you're trying to solve in the game. I suppose these could all be classified as red herrings, which are not inherently bad, but for me, it was just a bit excessive. Other than those couple scenes, though, I loved the design of every environment, and equally lovely were the designs of the various characters, all of whom were drawn with such personality that you can almost guess how each character will sound even before you hear their voice. The visual design here is absolutely stellar, and even with the limited resolution available to LucasArts artists at the time, they were able to get across each character's design more effectively than nearly any other game released around the same time. Even super subtle design additions like the stubble of Guybrush's beard were evocative and completely visible, despite each piece of Guybrush's stubble effectively being one pixel. There is definitely an art to pixel graphics, and the LucasArts team working on LeChuck's Revenge were on the top of their game. Also noteworthy are the game's animations, which are all exceedingly well done, with some even bordering on being some of the best, most character-driven animations I've ever seen in a 90s-era adventure game. There's one animation in particular, involving stuffing a fairly large dog into your jacket, that had me chuckle out loud, simply because it looked so ridiculously perfect and comical. That's simply one example in a series of different animations that looked spectacular, and I legitimately think the artists deserve all the respect in the world for what they were able to accomplish with LeChuck's Revenge. Given the technology available to them, the game surpasses every potential graphical expectation you may have. Moving on to the sound and music, I'm not going to beat around the bush. The music for LeChuck's Revenge is some of the best music I've ever heard in a video or computer game, and every single track perfectly captures the mood of each scene, and then elevates it to previously unheard of heights. While the composer's skill sets are obviously on display here, one of the biggest improvements for LeChuck's Revenge over its predecessor, and other adventure games around the time of its release, is the inclusion of the iMuse music system, which stitched together various musical, melodic, and rhythmic alterations to make the game feel like it truly had a personalized soundtrack, made just for my playthrough. Future games in the LucasArts game catalog would continue to use iMuse, though for my money, I truly believe this first effort is one of the best implementations of the dynamic soundtrack technology anywhere. And if you happen to have a Roland MT32, which was the DOS sound card everyone longed for back in the early 90s, you are in for a treat, because the synthesized music sounds so good that you'd be forgiven for thinking that the composers had access to a pirate orchestra providing true instrumental tracks. I, unfortunately, do not have a standalone MT32, though I do really want one, but I was able to use MT32 emulation using ScumVM, and let me tell you, it still sounds remarkable. Seriously, this is one of the best soundtracks ever found in a game, and I would listen to these tracks in my daily life, no question about it. Beyond the soundtrack, there's not a whole lot to talk about from a sound perspective, other than the various sound effects included in different sections of the game, all of which match the action on the screen perfectly. I have zero complaints about any aspect of the auditory environment of the game, and in fact, believe it was a stellar experience all around. Moving on to the narrative and story, you play as Guybrush Threepwood, a dashing swashbuckler whose transition to full-scaled pirate from the original game is now complete. At the beginning of the game, you find yourself in a tricky situation, dangling precariously over a pit with only the tiniest thread of a rope holding your weight and keeping you from plummeting to a rocky fall. Elaine, former governor of Melee Island, finds you in this dangerous predicament and inquires as to how you managed to wind up in the situation that you're in. This, of course, sets up a flashback sequence that persists for pretty much the entire game, which presents a far-reaching adventure where you are in search of the legendary lost treasure of Big Whoop, taking you across numerous islands in search of glory. Along the way, you meet a huge cast of characters, solve a ridiculous number of puzzles, and ultimately discover some hidden truths about LeChuck, the main antagonist from the first Secret of Monkey Island game. Hopefully, you'll emerge victorious. Otherwise, it's possible that LeChuck will end up having his revenge, after all. The story here is universally excellent, 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 with a well-constructed narrative, a strong setup, and ultimately an absolutely insane twist ending that I am still processing. Obviously, no spoilers here, but I don't believe it's hyperbole to say that the ending was one of the most crazy twists in an adventure title, if not in all of gaming, that truly showed that LucasArts was unafraid to defy expectations. I know that many people have complained about the way the game ended, but from my perspective, it is nearly perfect, as it shines an entirely different light on the entire game, if not the entire series up to this point, calls into question all of the experiences you've had so far, and leaves you wondering where the story could possibly go next. As I understand it, the recently released Return to Monkey Island picks up pretty much right where LeChuck's Revenge leaves off, and while I haven't played that one yet, I am now incredibly curious as to how that game handles the game's ending. I also haven't played Curse of Monkey Island previously, the game that immediately follows LeChuck's Revenge, so I know that title handles the ending in some capacity as well. I want to play that one also, though the fact that Ron Gilbert wasn't involved with Curse of Monkey Island, and was in fact the designer behind Return to Monkey Island, kinda makes me want to play Return a bit more than Curse. Most likely, I'll simply play the games in order that they were released, but I've gotta say, regardless of what I end up doing, the ending for LeChuck's Revenge has piqued my curiosity more than any other game's ending in recent memory. Moving away from the ending, which was crazy, the majority of the story is delivered via dialogue and exchanges with other characters, and here the game strikes a perfect mix of completely non-essential comedic dialogue options and completely essential comedic dialogue options, and from my perspective, the game's dialogue is written so well that you really want to click on and experience every line of dialogue you have access to. It's not often that a game can make me laugh out loud, legitimately, but LeChuck's Revenge did so, almost whenever it felt like it. Now, I'm not saying the entire game will have you rolling on the floor laughing your butt off, but the entire game does have a quality to its comedic writing that is nearly unmatched in all of gaming. In fact, the writing is so good that this is the first adventure game that my 7-year-old daughter actually showed an interest in playing with me, with two early game encounters making her laugh out loud in the way that only a 7-year-old can do. The first laugh-out-loud moment was when I was speaking with the woodworker on Scab Island as we debated back and forth about how much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood, which eventually rose to obscene levels of quality writing and wordplay, which both my daughter and I loved. The second laugh-out-loud moment of the early game was when we were talking to a couple of shanty-loving pirates, and one of them began a rousing rendition of 99 Bottles of Beer in the Wall. As you listen to one of the pirates count down the titular bottles of beer, you have an option of augmenting his count with a different number, which effectively resets his progress. We tried each option because that's how I play adventure games, but the truly funny moment came when we let the pirate get down to just a couple of bottles of beer left. I was interested in seeing what the game would do if he truly did reach no bottles of beer, so I sat there with bated breath, just waiting to see what wonderful comedy would unfold. Well, the pirate gets down to a bottle of beer before the other pirate shouts out some ridiculous number like 502, resetting the song back to the beginning. I let out an audible what the heck, and my darter burst out laughing. Honestly, one of my favorite gaming moments in recent months. The bottom line here is that the story never disappoints, and the dialogue is better than it has any right being. I have literally no critiques. Moving on to the playability and controls, from a control perspective, LeChuck's Revenge controls pretty much exactly how any other scum-based game controls, where you use the mouse exclusively to interact with the environment, characters, inventory items, and other world hotspots. And here, the game performs perfectly. The controls are simple, sure, but they are 100% effective, and controlling LeChuck's Revenge feels as modern as any other current adventure game. The control scheme has not aged a day. Looking at the overall playability of the title, you can probably surmise that I felt the game was nearly perfect, with incredibly designed and difficult puzzles peppering the game throughout, which I enjoyed solving immensely. That said, there were a few design elements here that I thought fell a little flat, and as I promised, let's talk about which puzzles and design elements I thought could have used some refinement. The first situation that I have some critique on is the antique dealer, and the way in which you acquire certain items. For those who haven't played the game, the antique dealer appears on Booty Island, and runs a shop that contains a fairly large inventory of items that you can purchase, assuming you have enough pieces of 8, which is the game's currency. My issue lies not with the number of items that can be purchased, but with the fact that some items telegraph initially as non-purchasable, but are in fact required purchases to be successful in your quest. I critiqued a specific puzzle in Darkseid recently where you have to examine an item multiple times before you can retrieve it without any indication that multiple examinations would result in a different end result. Well, that same mechanic is alive and well in this part of LeChuck's Revenge, and I have to say, I am not a huge fan. If there was some indicator that additional inspections may have been needed, then that would have been fine. But assuming someone is going to examine something multiple times in the hopes that the text changes is, from my perspective, a poorly designed interaction. It's not an egregious design decision, but it is one that I really don't prefer. And speaking of pieces of eight, the hand puzzle that you need to decipher in order to win a series of wheel-based prizes on Fat Island is another one that I didn't particularly enjoy. I ended up coming up with a number of different possible options and algorithms to help me arrive at the solution, though every time I thought I had figured it out, it turns out my logic failed. I was ultimately able to get past this one without using a guide, though it turns out the logic that I thought applied was actually much more convoluted than the actual answer, which was deceptively simple. This is one that I have mixed emotions about, because I could see the logical leap needed to arrive at the correct solution, but I also think that the logical leap was a bit more obscure than I would have liked. This is another one that I felt could have been designed just a bit better. Perhaps my least favorite, but almost truly favorite puzzle in the game involves a spitting competition that you end up encountering on Booty Island. I am so divided on this puzzle. On one hand, the solution, which is a multi-part effort, is so ingenious and perfect that it might be one of my favorite puzzles of all time. On the other, the solution involves such a discrete, specific observation that I felt like its subtlety and apparent randomness made me irrationally angry, and was therefore my least favorite puzzle in the game. At the same time, there was a very subtle hint available in the nearby Governor's Mansion, which if applied to this scene, makes it my favorite puzzle in the game. You see what I mean? I am completely divided here, and I don't know how I should feel. I suppose my final answer is, no, I still don't know how I feel, but I respect the puzzle's design as something truly unique. Other than those puzzles, the rest of the game is pretty much perfect, though I do have a couple of additional comments and critiques. For one, the library on Fat Island is both a great addition to the game because it has some truly funny book titles included, while also being an irritating addition to the game because it contains so many red herrings that it can obscure the truly important books that you should be focusing on. There were a few situations while I was trying to solve a couple puzzles that I came across books that I thought were perfect potential solutions, only to find that they were completely superfluous. One in particular I thought I was being incredibly clever on, but it turns out I was simply going down the wrong path. Recall our discussion on the spitting competition from a couple minutes ago. As I was trying to figure out the solution for that one, I explored the library and discovered a book called Great Expectorations, written by pirate Captain Loogie. I thought, awesome, this has got to have a clue, because one of the monikers you can select when you begin the spitting contest is none other than Captain Loogie. But no, absolutely nothing to do with it, just some fun flavor text. I appreciated the humor, but I thought this one was a bit too close to the spitting puzzle to not have something to do with it. It wasn't a huge deal, but it was something that made me slightly irritated. My final critique has to do with a close-to-endgame scenario that involves you being trapped with seemingly no way to interact with anything nearby. I tried literally everything to solve this one, and ended up sort of dying once because I ran out of time, which, like I mentioned earlier, was gracefully handled by the game, so no real issue there. My big complaint is that doing the thing the game expects actively changes your verb commands, which then allows you to solve the situation you're facing. This, I thought, was a bit cheap, because earlier in the game, you do the same thing, but your verb commands do not change. Having a certain item do two different things at two different parts of the game, when used in the same exact way, was, in my opinion, not the cleanest design decision. Other than those relatively minor critiques, I loved LeChuck's Revenge from beginning to end. So overall, how did it feel to play LeChuck's Revenge? Well, honestly, it just felt like a breath of fresh air, because it was one of the most funny, charming, challenging, and well-put-together adventure games I've ever played. I'd go so far as to say it might be my new favorite adventure game of all time. I still need to deliberate on that a bit, but suffice it to say, the game feels amazing to play. So overall, what is our verdict on LeChuck's Revenge? This is probably not a surprise, but LeChuck's Revenge is 100% deserving of a spot in our pantheon of classic gaming, and it is not even close. This was one of those rare experiences where nearly every aspect of a game comes together into a perfect combination of awesomeness, and I can safely say that my first playthrough of LeChuck's Revenge is one that is going to stick with me the rest of my life. I cannot believe I never played this one before, but I am infinitely glad that I rectified that issue. As one of the best adventure games ever created, LeChuck's Revenge is something literally everyone should play at some point in their gaming careers, and as such is an obvious choice as our newest inductee into our pantheon of classic gaming. That was our episode on Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT, I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. I highly encourage you all to check it out. I also encourage you to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a Patreon exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, Patreon.com/classicgaming today is where it's at. Before we sign off for the week, I do want to mention that our next episode is going to be focused on Mike Tyson's Punch-Out for the NES, so feel free to write in if you have any particularly fond or not so fond memories of that experience. I'd also like to remind everyone that in around a month, we will have our first listener grab bag episode for our Sounds of the Classics feature. So if you have any games and music that you want featured in that episode, send me a note either via email, X, Discord, in whatever way you want. Send it to me, send me your personalized message, and I'll make sure it's included in the episode. At the same time, I recognize you're likely listening to this podcast on any number of podcast engines, and if you would feel so inclined, it would be great if you could leave me a review. This is not about bolstering star counts. This is not about trying to harvest a ton of 5-star ratings, though if that happens, awesome, it means we're doing something right. No, what it's really all about is trying to get the feedback necessary to make sure that I can make this the best possible podcast I can. We get new listeners every single day, which is absolutely amazing. I want to continue to make sure I'm delivering the content you all want to listen to, and the only way to do that is to get feedback from all of you. We'll be back in around a week with our next episode focused on Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. Until then, remember, sometimes the games of the past are just as good, if not better, than the games of today. Goodbye, everyone.